Angie's List is now Angie, the nation's largest home services marketplace. And Angie is here to help homeowners get all their jobs done well. Angie has helped over 150 million homeowners care for their homes. Whatever your home project, big or small, indoor or outdoor, come to Angie to connect with and hire skilled professionals to get the job done well. My son needed a major yard cleanup at his new home. We went straight to the Angie website and found a bunch of local, reliable, and affordable pros to handle the job, and one did pronto. Angie can help you find the best price for your project. Angie lets you request and compare quotes from multiple pros in just a few taps, or book services at an upfront price based on local data. Angie has cost guides that tell you what others have paid for similar projects, both nationally and in your area. Get started at Angie.com. That's ANGI.com, or download the app today. The app and website are free to use. Hello, ladies. Hello, gentlemen. This is the Victor Davis Hanson Show. We're recording in late August, but you're listening to this particular podcast most likely on September 6th. That's when it is originally airing. And we are in the midst of a series of podcasts being done while Victor is teaching at Hillsdale College, which on September 6th, that's what he's doing. He's up there for 2 weeks. Oh, Victor. Yeah, he's the namesake and the star of this show, Victor Davis Hanson. He's the Martin and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution and the Wayne and Marsha Buskey Distinguished Fellow in History at the aforementioned Hillsdale College. Victor writes a lot of original material. First of all, he writes a ton of stuff, American Greatness, New Criterion, many other places, but a lot of original material for his website, victorhanson.com. I'm going to get the plug in right now. Go to it. Subscribe. $5 for the first time, $50 for a year. You're missing tens of thousands of words a month of Victor's wisdom if you don't do that. Okay, plug done. So these podcasts we are recording in late August, we're doing six of them, and they're based on questions that you listeners have kindly submitted, knowing that we were going to be doing this. And we've got a few questions about people who work with their hands, something Victor has talked and written about many times in the past, but we're going to hear his wisdom once again, and we're going to get to these questions right after these important messages.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We're back with the Victor Davis Hanson Show, my friend. We've just recorded a podcast which talked about farming, and we're gonna one of these questions coming up is about farming. It's amazing as you were talking, and I'm looking at the kind of questions I was going to ask in forthcoming podcasts, and you've talked about, you know, collecting the almonds from almond trees and having to mallet, rubber mallet trees. I'm thinking, my God, what kind of backbreaking work goes into farming?
And by the way, you can kill a rattlesnake with a mallet because it was in the foothills. And every time we were there, there would be a little hole about every time we went to work, there'd be about the seventh hole. There would be a seventh tree. There'd be a little hole with a snake with his head out, and bam.
Was it just
rubber mallet?
Was it because it was the foothills, or do they have some association with almond trees?
Well, you know, it's shady and it's dry, especially in August when you harvest. So
okay,
this was a weird orchard on the foothills, but there's not. Our great grandparents, where I live, got rid of the California Pacific rattlesnakes, and I think it was about 1910. They had these rattlesnake and jackrabbit hunts where they'd hold hands and they would walk across the field for miles, and then they would drive the jackrabbits and the rattlesnakes and kill them all. And so when I grew up, not that rattlesnakes were not native to the San Joaquin Valley. They were weak. I thought they were only a foothill and mountain species, but that was only because they had been driven from one of their natural habitats. That was a natural habitat for them too. The foothills and the Sierra below 5,000, 6,000 feet. But wow, I saw one rattlesnake in my entire life out here in Fresno County.
Oh, wow.
By the river, you see them once in a while, but I saw one, and it was only on the Kings River. And I think when I've been up in the mountains, I see a lot of them. And so they got rid of them all in a very ecologically, we should condemn them. We were talking about the abuses of history. So we're going to use our own moral code to say those awful people in 1910
right.
were paranoid about those venomous snakes,
right.
and they had no business doing that. And they ruined the echo world or the echo sphere because of there's no more poor little Pacific rattlesnakes in
and mean to the jackrabbits.
Not that also. There are places, but not where I live. They're not.
Yeah,
but we have beautiful little garter and especially gopher snakes. I love those snakes. We see them everywhere.
You're kind of neat. Now, the snakes are a part of the life of a farm and
keeping
rid of rodents, them. Right?
They're not venomous.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let me engage in this people who work with their hands questions, Victor. And the first is about farming, and it's you'll get the gist of the question. It wasn't written with the greatest precision, but it's from Blunderbuss, which I have a feeling is a nickname because I never heard of Saint Blunderbuss. How can we increase the number of family farmers and middle class farmers? Who would be without huge funding or vertical integration, which are available to corporate agriculture? That gets me a little. It's a little fuzzy on the tenses, et cetera. But in general, I guess there's there's two questions there. Is there a need for more farmers of a non-corporate type? And I can't imagine. Well, I can't imagine doing that other than having a small farm because it's some kind of idyllic dream. But as a business, getting into farming as a business that's not corporate, yeah. How do you do that? Is it a crazy dream? Go ahead.
In 1996 and 1998, I wrote two books on this subject. One was called Fields Without Dreams. Jane Smiley, who wrote 1,000 Acres, wrote the introduction to the second book. I'm sure she regrets it now, called Letters from an American Farmer. I discuss this topic. And to boil down those two books, it's there's a dichotomy. When you go to the store anywhere in the United States and you see fresh apples and plums and peaches and grapes and carrots and celery, and it's clean, it's nutritious, and it's cheap, at least it was until Joe Biden became president. There's a reason for that. And when you go to a farmer's market and it doesn't look as pristine and it's a little ripe and it tastes better, it's probably more nutritious and it's more expensive, there's a reason for that. And when you go, let's say you get on, I don't know, Avenue 7, Manning Avenue, anything that goes Shields Avenue across California, and you get past 30 miles east of the Sierra and you get closer to the Coast Ranges and you don't see anybody living out there. And yet, when you go down the 99, you see Visalia, and you see Kingsburg, and you see Selma, and you see Fowler, and Fresno, and Madera, and Merced, and Modesto. And that was where the railroad was. That was where there was water. So there were historical reasons for that. It was basically the aquifer and the riparian ecosystem from the Sierra Nevada. Okay, what I'm saying is this is that there's a dichotomy that corporate agriculture cannot be faulted about providing us food. Nobody does it better because they're vertically integrated. That is, they own the food producing lands, which they don't make a lot of money per acre on. Usually they own the trucking, they own the packing, the processing, and the brokerage. And the farmer is at the bottom of that chain. He only produces, and he is dependent on a packer, on a trucker, on a broker, on a supermarket. And he has no control over that price. So every dollar that you pay for agricultural produce, he gets about 2 or 3 cents. And he argues that, but if you look at those communities that I just listed, they were rich cultural institutions. You go down there, they had beautiful post offices. They had beautiful train stations. You go to the city hall, they're beautiful examples of architecture. They all had parks in the middle, just like in the Midwest or the East Coast, Jack. They have World War II memorials. They have a cannon here. They have a statue there. And they have these beautiful little downtowns. And that was a cultural experience. And those families then raised boys and girls for America. And they came, and they were, because they emphasized the practical, that these boys and girls were not abstract thinkers. They had to test their theories, their mind works, so to speak, by physical labor. And that's what the farmer does. If you say, oh, I have a new variety of plums and I think it's going to be so great. Okay, then plant it, borrow the money, do the labor and see what happens when it's no damn good. You'll go broke. So you're very reluctant to take chances that are unfounded. So it was that corrective of abstract theorizing. It was wonderful. And they don't worry about diversity, equity, inclusion, because you're all in the same lot. So when I grew up here, if I'm looking around now in a 360, when I saw the Kosygians, or I saw the Israelians, or I saw a Mr. Mendoza, or I saw a Tarzan Ciota, or I saw various other ethnic groups, so-called non-white, nobody cared. What did you talk about? Oh, man, I have a Jubilee and it's out. Do you know how to fix the brushes on the generator? Can you do it for me? Or, you know what, I just cracked my Listers, can I borrow one? Or my vineyard wagon's bearings are out on the front wheel, can I borrow your tire? That kind of stuff. They didn't care. It was a natural multiculturalism, natural diversity. It wasn't enforced by a bunch of rarefied white people that are worried about their privilege, and they feel that they have to force upon us their noblesse oblige on race. So it was a wonderful incubator of that culture, and it's gone. And it's gone because they did everything perfectly.
Right.
They created the good citizen, the good community. They were the bedrock of the United States. They produced good, nutritious varieties, Alberta peaches, Santa Rosa plums, Thompson seedless girdle grapes, just delicious. But if you are a highly suburbanized and urban population and you need that type of food delivered to your door thousands of miles from where it's, then you need somebody that has the ability to do that. And that means they have a refrigerated truck and they have particular chemicals and they have particular protocols and they have particular varieties of fruit that looks good. But you drop a modern peach or a plum and it'll bounce on the floor. It's hard, right? And they don't taste any good. You take a regular peach that you buy right in Dayton, Ohio, and you try to eat it like an Alberta peach. You take an right Alberta peach and you try to send it to Ohio. It's going to be mush when it gets there.
Right.
So they were local producers, and you ate seasonal fruit. So if you were in Ohio or Michigan, you ate plums or peaches or whatever would grow. But you didn't get, you know, Chilean grapes. Right. In February. But so corporate agriculture gave you all these choices and all these new varieties of fruits and vegetables, and it was wonderful, and it was cheap, and they were safe, and they were nutritious, but they didn't feel that that agriculture was agrarianism, or it had social or cultural responsibilities or liabilities. And small farming did, and small farming can't compete with that. So if you're in Europe, the Europeans have decided, and I'm not a big fan of Europe's socioeconomic paradigms, but they have decided if you go to rural France and picturesque the English countryside, or you go into the wonderful places of the Peloponnese in Greece or Italy up in, you know, Tuscany, they say, you know, this is worth saving. So we're going to subsidize these people. We're going to have price supports and this and that. And it's can be very expensive. Food's much more expensive in Europe, but it is tend to be more local. And then you go out in the country and you see these beautiful small little farms. Right. And, you know, and that's not what we do. That's not what America does. And I have mixed emotions about it. But what I'm not going to do, and I decided when I wrote those books 25 years, I was not going to romanticize agriculture or agrarianism to the extent that I was going to lie about corporate agriculture and say it's inefficient or it's dangerous or it's toxic. And I can tell you that I farmed here as a fifth generation, and this farm was cluttered. I mean, I had antiques and I had old fence posts and I had piles of this and piles of that, because every generation never knew when they'd have to cannibalize an old piece of equipment. And we had alleyways that were picturesque, and we had trees lined. There were tree-lined little, it was almost like the English countryside. And we had an artesian pond, and it was beautiful. But my God, when you tried to farm and you had a 5-acre parcel here and a 3-acre over there and a 15-acre over there, it was not efficient. So when all of our neighborhood went corporate and corporate agriculture came in, what they did with me, they said, we will rent this place and you should see it now. They just leveled it and they tore out all that. And they tore out all the irrigation systems, and they planted this beautiful grid with satellite efficiency and precision. And GPS, and my God, every tree is perfectly aligned, and it looks like a park. It's beautiful.
Is it strictly almonds, or is there any?
Yes, it's monocrop. You don't do that on 45. You do not. We would have, 10 different varieties in some 40-acre parcels.
Right.
And, we had it geared toward fresh fruit for Santa Cruz, fresh fruit for Palo Alto, fresh fruit for San Luis Obispo, Monterey, Carmel, and then we would, it was a lot of work. I did that for 20 years.
Yeah. When was the last time you were I hate to put it this way, but actually farming? When were you still?
Well, I
may still be in a sense.
Well, I was full time.
Right.
When I left graduate school and came home in 1980. And then I did that for 5 years. And then in 84, I started teaching part time Latin for a year. And then I tried to suggest I could start a classics department at club. I was the only classics professor. That's another story altogether, but I met a really brilliant guy, Bruce Thornton, and he and I partnered and we created a classics department. So then I was full-time, but I kept farming with my family, my two brothers and cousin. And I did that for another 5 years. So that 10 years. And then I got kind of ill because I was farming full time. And I mean by full time, driving up to Fresno at 8 o'clock to teach a Latin class, driving back home to check on, a picking crew, eating lunch, driving back up to Fresno to teach a Greek literature class and humanities, driving back home, and sometimes three times. And when I say up and back, I don't mean 5 minutes, I mean 28 miles. So I was, and I had old cars, so I would be breaking down and I would pick up parts in Fresno I did all that. And then in the 90s, I positioned out of that. So I was a member of the farming partnership, but I was more like advisor, or I did stuff. My father, I helped him. He was involved in it too, but I wasn't out on a tractor. And then it was all located at my house. So we had a big packing house, 30 or 40 people here at my house. And so I had all the workers here. And then at night I would go out and help clean up. But I had a twin brother who was an entire workaholic. I mean, if you think I'm a workaholic, he was getting up at 5 a.m. and he was on a tractor all day long, and then he was managing it. So that took a lot off the responsibility when I kind of faded out of the picture. And then after it was all broken up, we have 5 people and you only have 180 acres and then you have 5 spouses. You've got 10 different agendas.
Right.
And when prices in the 2000 became rock bottom, they weren't even, I mean, we had been getting, I don't know, $14 for Black Butte plums to take one advantage. By 2005, they were $4. We had been getting $14.20 a ton for raisins. And by 2003, they were $600, $700,
$800. Damn.
You couldn't make it. So
right.
That was the big and then unfortunately, the people in my family that either had to sell or wanted to sell sold out at a very low price for the most part. And the land that I see now, that area around me, it's 30 or 40,000 an acre now. And it's kind of sad because I walk every night with my four dogs, and we go around the perimeter of my 40 acres, but we go around the perimeter also of my great-great-grandfather, my great-grandfather, my parents' land, and it's all owned by other people. And I don't blame anybody for selling out. I don't know how anybody survived. They didn't. And, you know, I had a brother who had a master's degree in biology. So he was highly educated. And I had another brother with a master's degree. And it was very hard for them to make a living. I was lucky that that I had a job in town. But I did that for, I guess you'd say, 10 or 12 years full time while I was teaching part of that time. And then I kind of was advisory and puttered on weekends and did stuff when, you know, there was nobody around. Or what I mean by that is if somebody call up and say, I've got to go fix the tractors or there's a broken concrete pipeline, Victor, can you? And I would go out on the weekends and do stuff like that. And then the last, when it was all broken up, then everybody went their own way. And I had 40 acres and I just couldn't do it and teach and travel and write.
Right.
So I rented it out.
Victor.
And I finally decided that there was no money in any of it. The vines were just losing money. So I just said to the renter, that's it, I'm done. And then I didn't know what to do. And then a very wonderful guy came by and said, he was a big corporate farmer, but he was wonderful, Furman Compost. And he said, Victor, I'm going to be leasing a lot of land in your area. I want to integrate your 41 acres with all of this other land and make it almonds, and I'll line up all the plots and it'll be very good for me. And he turned it into a beautiful farm. I mean, it's a state-of-the-art almond farm now, and he leases it from me.
Right.
And I really admire him. And he's another American success story.
Oh yeah.
Family, you know, Tony.
I know Tony. I've been guy from the Bronx going to the almond processing plant. It's just, wow.
That's his uncle. I mean, that's the thing that people don't understand about Central California. If you look at the Compost family, the original two brothers and then second generation, they were from Basque. Or you look at the Parnagians and Fowler Packing and what they've done with mandarins. It's just incredible.
Yeah.
So you have, I know when I mean incredible, these are family corporations, but the state of the art technology,
right.
They compete globally and they produce a very nutritious product. It's safe and they can do it at a price that's cheaper than people in Spain or Greece.
Right.
And they're really admirable
people. Admirable, big time. Yeah. Hey, Victor, before we get on to the other, part of the question, but people working with their hands. If you quickly, I'm just curious again, I mentioned boy from the Bronx, even though I think I've told you in the past, I used to work on a fruit and vegetable delivery truck through, you know, so I always had an affinity for fruit crate labels and where Andy Boy Broccoli was being. But as you were growing, when you were growing up, were these associations that have nothing to do with where I grew up, 4-H and the Grange, were these a part of your life as a kid growing up? And how much were they part of the community of the Central Valley towns?
We had the Farm Bureau. which everybody belonged to. And then there were the Granges were starting to they were there and they started to fade when I was there. But they had the Future Farmers of America with the Blue Jackets. And my brother was a future farmer. He had to buy a steer and raise it. And yeah, there were all of these. There was the Raisin Bargaining. It's still there, association. I was a member of that. I was a member of the Sun-Made Raisin Cooperative. In fact, they owed me $89,000, my brothers and I, when they went recapitalized. And we never got most of it. And so I knew all of those. I was a member of the... I had Farm Bureau health insurance for my family. I was a member of Farm Bureau. I used to be a subscriber to Truton, a fruit tree grower and grape grower magazine. And I used to read those nonstop. It was very funny because I'd be in my office and somebody would come in and I would be, you know, I had to, when you have a small classics department of four or five people, you have a, you can't offer the rich level of coursework you'd like. So you do independent studies, a lot of work. So I would be offering an independent study and Lysias's On the Cripple, or maybe Xenophon's Poroi, or Satyricon by Petronius. And at the same time, I'd be reading Grape Grower magazine or Western Tree Fruit Grower. And I would be looking at pack tanks and all the different type of machinery. And people would come in and they couldn't figure out whether I was an ag professor. And then I would go over to the ag department and there were some good guys there, but they weren't actual farmers. You know what I mean? They were kind of like, so it was a very strange schizophrenic. It still is, because although I'm not actively farming, I live on a farm and I'm with farmers all day in the vicinity. And then I go to Hoover on each week. And it's just such a, I've been doing this. It's a cultural
show. Going to Mars. Yeah.
I've been doing that since I was a student at 18 at UC Santa Cruz, a student at Stanford, commuting back and forth. And sometimes it just mind boggling the cultural differences in 3 or 4 hours that you experience. And the wealth of talent in the San Joaquin Valley.
Yeah.
And I was just talking to a guy the other day, Simon Ciotta, and my gosh, I said, you know anything about, I'm putting a conduit. Yes, I can do this, Victor. And I'll do the cement. And I think my pump is starting. Don't worry about that. I have a guy to do that. And then I said, is there anything you can't do? And I mean, it's just all of these people with these enormous numbers of skills. And I see him on the phone. He's speaking in his native Indian, you know, as a Sikh immigrant, and then all of a sudden he's speaking fluent Spanish, and then he speaks English better than I do, and you have all highly educated. It's just amazing to see the number of people that we kind of forget in the other California that are just, gosh. And then when I drive into Palo Alto and I see these trucks, you know, refrigerated trucks and stuff, they're coming over Pacheco Pass and everything, and coming up 101 on the Salinas Valley, and they're just bringing in tons, millions of pounds of fruit and vegetables to the entire Silicon Valley, 9 million Bay Area people. And then I go out in the evening some days and I see all bringing all the other stuff out, you know. Right. And I keep thinking, okay, we're using your cell phones and your Google searches, but you guys, and that's really nice and that helps us farm, but you wouldn't eat if these people didn't truck this stuff in.
Struck me many years ago, Victor, and we got to move on to this next question, but how intelligent and how, as you say, you're consumed with your trade at the time. You knew what you were doing. And remember when, I think it was during the 88 Democratic primary, may have been Michael Dukakis or somebody telling the farmers in Iowa who were having real trouble with corn prices at the time. Well, why don't you grow Belgian endive?
I remember that. That was almost as good as Mike Bloomberg. Remember, drop the seed. Kind of go on autopilot and it sprouts. And these guys aren't very smart. They just kind of drop a seed and bang.
Yeah. Oh, I'll grow the Belgian end. Thank you for the suggestion.
Hey,
all
Mike,
right, well, anyway.
You know, you just kind of, you know, just kind of an idea in your head, and you say, I'm going to have kind of a worldwide information about stocks, and you call it Bloomberg, and you just sit back and you make your worth $60 billion. That was easy, wasn't it?
Right. All right. People who work with their hands are going to get to an important question about this right after these messages.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
We're back with the Victor Davis Hanson Show. This show is being recorded late August and is going to be up on September 6th on the World Wide Webs. On September 6th, the great Victor Davis Hanson, who I have the great pleasure to be talking with today twice a week. He's teaching up at Hillsdale, which is, I think this is the 19th or 20th year that Victor is doing that. So, Victor, while we were preparing for these podcasts, many people sending questions. And here's one from Christopher Ott. A little preamble. I've owned a small business specializing in specialty automotive repairs and parts manufacturing. My generation, Generation X, grew up with an emphasis from society on college and not trades. I did attend college, but working with the hands and the mind was far more appealing. Instead, I opened a business and have run it continuously for 34 years. In that period, I've seen a massive reduction in all trade skills, and it's troubling. Mechanics, plumbers, electricians, AC techs, etc. In our area of the world, these trades are mostly being filled by first-generation immigrants. In addition, it seems that the average citizen has lost their ability to do basic hands-on repairs of any type. Very few of the people I know could replace a light switch or unclog a drain. This seems a massive strategic issue for the United States. What would his, that's you, Victor, what would Victor's thoughts be of this? And Victor, we have about 8 minutes left. So.
I agree entirely. I mean, what saved me as a person, if I am saved, were the 8 or 9, 10 years when I came back with a PhD at 25 on the farm and then growing up earlier. And by that, I mean, I had to go lay cement with my parents or my grandparents. So I know how to lay cement. I know every aspect of it. And I know how to hammer and to build a building. I had to do that. I put in a sewer system with 4-inch PVC, et cetera, et cetera. I fix all of my irrigation on my sprinkler system. I know how to prune trees. I know how I've put in about 3 roofs, composition roofs. I shouldn't be turned loose on wiring because amateurs are dangerous because they try to do more than they know, but I've done that. I go into the house 3 or 4 times a year to fix the plumbing. I think about 3 or 4 months ago, the main water, 1-inch, it's only 1-inch. It's an ancient water supply to the house in the middle, blew up at night. And my wife and I were out in mud for 2 or 3 hours where we tried to dig down 4 feet, find the line, and then get a coupling on galvanized pipe. And we did that. My garage is full of every type of extra part I can think of in case something happens out here. I have a 1-acre yard. It's just so I did all that. And that was in addition to, I think I could still drive most tractors. I got kind of rusty. I don't know the new computer drive, but I drove almost every tractor. Massey, Ford, Oliver, David Brown, you name it. I could drive it pretty well. I was pretty good at it. Not as good as my brother. I drove every spray rig. I know how to do that. I could fix things. And my father insisted on that. And he, one last thing, because I know we're out of time now, I think it's very valuable. And I try to teach my children that. And they are very mechanical. At times I kind of overdid it because I didn't learn classical languages in high school. And I was an undergraduate and kind of caught up. And so I was a philologist. By that, I mean, I went to a program where it was not archaeology or history, but pure Latin and Greek. And, you know, I didn't go to prep school, so I wanted to master those. And you had to learn. So that meant hours of study. And then I went to the American School of Classical Studies. But long and short of it, at certain times, I kind of crashed and burned. I got E. coli in Greece, very serious from eating strawberries that had been, you know, fertilized with night soil. And then I got a severe staghorn calculus when I got, so I got very ill, almost died, had to be flown home and be operated. But when I came, my father said something to me I'll never forget. He said, "You don't get sick. Your body allows these things to do it to you because you're not balanced, Victor.
Right.
Your brothers are balanced. All you're doing is reading. And you should see yourself. You sit there and read that damn Greek or Latin and you need to get out. So you've got a serious kidney problem and I'm going to cure you." So for that summer, he made me wear shorts, tan, no shirt. And I was, you know, I had all these surgical scars, really big operation. I was still weak from the equine. And I tagged along with him. And I was 25 and we did farm work. He said, "When it's all over." And I never forgot that. So when I had a bad case of mono in my 30s, kind of the same thing, exhaustion, and then you try to get over it. And so when I got this COVID, long COVID, I kept doing it. I kept going to, I went to Israel with a group, I went back east, and then finding this little voice said, "Listen to your grandfather and father and go back to their farm and stay there. And it's not the physical work there that's going to kill you. It's this damn constant reading, stressed." And so I've been healing. So what I'm getting at is that I think it's really important for all of us to have some kind of physicality in our lives, both because the body matches the mind, but it also gives us an empathy to people who work with their hands and who provide us with stuff. So I'll just finish with this final anecdote. So I've mentioned this constant remodeling project, and it started in January, and it's so labor short. It's still going on, but I always think about these guys that are out here working. What if they got COVID? Well, two of them did. So I just thinking, I said to my wife the other day, Jesus had COVID and he's a painter and he's inhaling all that stuff. And if he doesn't work, he doesn't get paid.
Right.
And so I've been texting him and I'm thinking, God, these guys, I mean, I'm lucky because I can do, if I don't feel well right now, it doesn't matter. I can do this. But what if I had to make my living inhaling paint right now? You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So if you do stuff like that, you get empathy for the people who do it all the time. And I think that's really important because, as I said at the beginning of one of our earlier podcasts today, our first, it's not the painter, it's not the plumber, it's not the electrician, it's not the sewer installer who's failing America. They do a better job than they ever did. It's not the guy in the plant that's putting together your truck. It's the people in the desk-bound, intellectual, techie, whatever they are, social media class. Those people have let us down. It's not the middle class, muscular class. They're better than ever.
Yeah.
The military people that are out and God knows where are the pilots. They are not letting us down. Or the airline pilots are not letting us down. It's people like the Pete Buttigiegs of the world that are letting us down. Those types of people are the Gavin Newsom class is letting us down. They are failing at what they do, but not the middle classes.
Yeah. You know, John Ratzenberger, who was Cliff Clavin on Cheers, the mailman.
I met him. He's a wonderful guy.
Oh, I love John. He lives in in Milford. Oh, I haven't seen him in a couple of years, but he had a show on Made in America that used to be on, I forget, the TLC or one of the cable channels. And John's, of course, great advocate for learning the trades, and not only because they're, if you were a welder in America, you're a rich man. If you become a plumber, you're going to own the town eventually. But he had some studies, just very dispiriting on, you know, the average age of a trade worker is really high. So this is the point of the question, you know, about this being a strategic problem for America. And one of the studies, like, you know, most Americans don't know how to change a tire on a car. He's right. How about to unclog a drain? So it is troubling, and it's a drum beat worth, you know, are continuing to beat on this and other podcasts. And I do have to say this, Victor, what the very first podcast you and I ever did a long time ago, when it was a National Review, you were great, but at the end you had told me you had passed out earlier that day. You were repairing plumbing under the house. You had a fever. And yet you were in the saddle to do so. You have the ability, and you continue to do things and yet perform intellectually. It's kind of
I had no hot water that day because of galvanized. When your pump goes off and it goes back on and goes back off, it tends to purge itself. And for the main sink in the house, it just sent all of this ancient rust. So I was under there trying to take all of the hot water pipe. And when you go deal with 3/4-inch corroded galvanized pipe, and you take off one coupling, it breaks. I don't even want to get into it.
So I'm sorry. I'm having flashbacks. Yeah. Well, anyway, to the folks who have asked us these questions and others who submitted questions, we really appreciate it. We have a few more of these listener question podcasts to record, and we will be doing that. Victor, thanks for your wisdom. I want to remind people to subscribe to Victor's website, victorhanson.com. For me, Jack Fowler, subscribe to the free weekly email newsletter I write, Civil Thoughts. You can do that at civilthoughts.com. And thanks to those who on Apple Podcasts leave us 5-star ratings, and that would be about 99% of the people who do leave ratings. So appreciate your confidence and your own appreciation of Victor's wisdom that we share now, I think, 5 times a week, twice with me, twice with the great Sammy Wink, and Victor himself interviewing people now. So it's all terrific. Thanks very much. Thank you, Victor. And we'll be back again soon with another episode of the Victor Davis Hanson Show. Bye-bye.
Yes. Thank you, everybody.